This is Claire Coyne. I'm interviewing Mary Harris on the 5th of December 2014 in her home near Latimer Road, and it's part of the MOLA Oral History Project. So, Mary, I just mentioned your name, but if you could introduce yourself and let me know the year that you were born and where you were born.
I was born in 1939 in Singapore, middle one of three children, two academic. My father was a professor of physics at Raffles College in those days, and my mother, who was a geologist, was also working as a physicist at the time at the Singapore Naval Base on radio direction finding.
That's wonderful. Well, we're mainly going to be focusing on the Temple of Mithras.
Yeah, sure.
However, if you could, just give me one or two sentences about your upbringing, which I know was actually quite colourful.
Yes. It was I think like most war children, I had an extraordinary childhood and eventually came to rest at boarding school in London. And my parents used to come over almost every summer. And because of the sort of school we went to, I suppose, and in those days you had to do Latin if you were hoping to go to university. And we were all generally interested in Romans, and my parents used to rent a flat somewhere in London, and London was flattened by the bombing, and so we used to spend a lot of time pottering around on Sunday afternoons after a very good lunch, seeing if we could find a bit more Roman London.
That sounds wonderful. Well, I mean, it sounds very evocative to me. I can visualise it. I know that you've got another reference point as well for Roman London and Roman history because of your dad's experience in the book that he got to know very well.
He was, although he was in the volunteers, Malayan volunteers like everybody was, he was actually doing a civilian job for the Navy. So he was actually captured by a civilian and interned not on the awful railway where so many people killed, but as a civilian on Singapore Island. And in the first few days of their captivity, the internees were allowed to scrounge. The Japanese weren't expecting to have to house so many. And they were allowed to scrounge food and things to read and things to do, musical instruments even. Even from their own homes. And one of the books that my father collected from his own home was Gibbon's Decline and Fall. And they were interned for about 3.5 years. So although obviously he read other things, there were a lot of other things the prisoners did by way of keeping alive. He set up a salt factory, for example, at one stage. But he, you know, by the time the war was over, he knew Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire off by heart, almost. He used to quote chunks of it, especially about the personalities of the different emperors.
That's wonderful. So by the time you were firmly established in London and having your summer holiday excursions around the city.
With the whole Roman thing was pretty familiar. You know, to all of us, I said we you know, you did Latin at school, and so most of us, I think all three of us, would have ploughed through Caesar's Gallic Wars by then, so we knew a bit about Roman army and things like that. But my father was a New Zealander, and before the war, he came over to do his PhD at the Cavendish in the glory days of Rutherford, and to pay his fees. He worked in King's College in London, and New Zealanders know that they are very short of ancient history because the Maoris, who were the first inhabitants, they didn't arrive until about the 12th century. So New Zealanders tend to be interested in ancient history. So he spent a lot of time on his own even before the war, but at about the time that he met my mother, who was also doing her PhD at Cambridge. They did quite a lot of pottering around the city of London anyway. We're finding bits of Roman all over the place.
So tell me your main impression or association with the Temple of Mithras excavation site.
I remember quite vividly a grey, miserable September day. And I've talked to my sister about this because her memory is rather better than mine. She's a bit younger. And she said that my father and I were on our own on this particular walk for some reason, but certainly she and my brother and my mother weren't there. And we'd gone down to the sort of Walbrook area, just really because it was an area we didn't know particularly well, just to see if we could find anything Roman emerging from the rubble, from the wartime Blitz rubble. And there was a dig going on in a rather sort of desultory way. And it was rather it was getting on towards the end of the day. And we noticed a flurry of excitement or activity. And I remember the atmosphere very well. And my father saying, they found something, I wonder what it is. So all the way home on the bus, we speculated as to what they might have found. And I can't remember whether it was the next day or a few days later. It was in the news that it was the head of Mithras, and what we'd been looking at was this temple being excavated.
How wonderful.
Yes, I do remember the atmosphere of... There's something about a dig when something is found. There's an electric sort of atmosphere goes on. I do remember that very vividly.
So did you go back? Because, as you know, it attracted lots of crowds and...
I think we must have done, because on the first day, I remember there being hardly any barriers. We just walked, you could more or less walk down into the dig, and because you respected what they were doing, you didn't. But I do remember later on there was hoardings up, and I think there might have been one of those platforms that they do nowadays when they're doing pre-construct digs, as they leave you a nice place to stand with a decent sized hole in the fence or whatever. So I think, so far as I remember, there were barriers built later, and then we knew that this was really serious.
And this was, as you know, again, a very specific cult or sort of component of the Roman history story, if you like. How much did you and your father know about that at the time?
I think nothing. I was going to say almost nothing, but I can't think of anything to justify the almost. We were much more into military history, and fortifications, for example. We spent a lot of time seeing if we could actually walk all the way around the walls of London and where they would have been if they'd been blitzed. I think that's... And my father got very excited because he found a place. There's a bit in the Barbican where there are niches in the walls that he hadn't understood until he read Gibbon. And they were places where a soldier, a sentry, would retreat into to salute or about turn or something military like that. I'm sorry to be so hopelessly ignorant about it, but it certainly excited him.
So he was starting to make connections between what he'd read and what he was seeing, which is
fantastic. Oh, definitely, yes, I think, yes. Well, he was a scientist anyway, and so scientists tend to do that. They look at the world through their own science, and this is happening because of that. So it was much the same. I think he was probably referring back to Gibbon most of the time. I think there was very little published in the popular press for archaeology in those days. Not like now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. Just going back to the furore around the Temple of Mithras and the site, you would have been 15
at
the time?
I was about 15, yes. Yeah.
I mean, I suppose it's quite a lot to ask, but were you aware that there was this big sort of debate going back that the media was sort of, well, arbitrating, expressing between what the public wanted done with the temple and what the politicians wanted done and what the developers wanted done and what the archaeologists wanted done?
I think I was aware of some sort of friction because it was fairly... Well, it was very soon after the end of the war, wasn't it? And people were beginning to rebuild London, and I was aware that there was some sort of argument that builders and no doubt politicians and developers actually wanted to get London going again, which was very understandable. And the archaeologists were saying, no, please wait until we finish digging here. I remember there was some sort of conflict like that.
And then eventually the temple was moved, kind of down the road. It was resited.
Yes, I do remember that. That was that came much later, after I'd married. And my husband worked in the city. And he also, it was one of the things we had in common, he had historical interests. And we used to do a bit of sort of city pottering on Sundays then, before we had the children. And I remember finding Mithras, the temple again, and telling him about finding the head. Wasn't it moved to somewhere at the back of Bucklersbury House or somewhere?
The head, first of all, went to the Guildhall.
Yes.
Oh, sorry, you're talking about the temple. Sorry, of course. Queen Victoria Street.
Yes, that would be about right. Yes.
And it was there till 2011, and then they...
And I remember it being labelled. Yes, I do remember finding it and then telling him that we'd been there when they found the head.
Can you remember what you thought about the reciting of it when you saw it?
Not really, other than I was glad that it had been preserved. I did know that it was in the wrong place. But... With a childhood like mine, and the war experience of my husband, who had also been a Far East prisoner of war, there was a bit of a generation between us, but that didn't matter because he had lost a lot, and me being a refugee, I'd sort of gained a lot. The war was actually everything. The war really was the war, and reconstruction, and growing up through rationing. So the city of London was in apparently sort of making it up as it went along in getting itself going again. It really was so heavily damaged, it's difficult for people to realise quite how badly battered London was. You know, the famous pictures of St Paul's rising above the smoke. It really was like that. I first came to England in 1946 by sea, and we came into Royal Albert Dock. And I remember that the City of London looked exactly like the pictures we'd seen in Picture Post. Just bits of old building sticking up, all grey. Most of the pictures in Picture Post were in black and white. I think they all were. But there were these spikes of purple, which was the Rose Bay willow herb. So that was a sign of regeneration. You know, we will get better, we will get over this.
That's a very lovely picture. I was just checking how far we were into the recording, because that's a lovely quotation, which,
it was such a vivid picture. My grandparents, who lived in Burnham Beeches, they must have hired a car, which in 1946 would have been hugely expensive, and petrol rationing and that sort of thing, to welcome us back, because they'd not met us three children. And my mother had been a refugee in New Zealand. For a while, she thought my father in Singapore was dead. So they'd all lived through all this. So it was a major event for my grandparents to come and pick us up at the Royal Albert Dock and drive us back down to Burnham Beaches to start their garden. It had an Anderson air raid shelter in it. And they'd put down a lot of the garden either to chickens or vegetables so they could be self-sustaining, and that's the way we lived. So I've got very vivid memories of that.
So going back to what you were, well, what we've been talking about throughout, really, about this very particular context of post-war London and Britain, and thinking about the crowds that went to see this site, this excavation site in 54. I mean, it was a phenomenal amount of people. What's your view on why so many people were drawn?
Oh, I can understand that, I think. Again, it was a sign of life getting back to normal. That here was something else that wasn't really to do with the war. Again, there was a sort of life goes on feeling. And everybody would have been there in their utility garments and things like that. Yes, I can understand that. It was such a sort of refreshing thing.
And I understand from your very particular experience and your father's interest in Roman history, how history became important to you. And you've said it's run throughout your life.
Mm.
How are you able to sum up why it's important and what it gives you?
I've often thought of that. And I think it goes back to being born into a very multicultural society. Singapore was. And there was a house full of students. They were on the other side of the road from the lecture rooms. And the door was always open to the students. The students were Malay, Chinese, Indian, Anglo-Indian, a real sort of mixture of people. From different backgrounds, and there was a lot of Chinese history I always found absolutely fascinating because it was so extraordinarily different. I was actually an early reader, and I used to, in a very strange childhood, I used to read a lot, and I used to get hold of books about ancient history and the pyramids and things like that. I was actually pushed into doing science at school because it's what my parents on the other side of the globe wanted. And I had to give up history to do that. And in a way, I always resented it. But once a child can read, there's actually no stopping them. So it's always been an interest. And it was wonderful when the Museum of London started up. We often used to visit that. And when I'm travelling, I've done a lot of travelling in my own work, one of the first things I do is to go to the local museum and to find out as much as I can about the country. I read a lot about the history of the Middle East. My husband was posted to the Sudan, and I got very interested in all the people who would have sailed up and down the Red Sea, which was everybody, of course, and the Greeks were still there. And that was quite amusing. Alexander stopped by and dropped a few off. No, that's not actually what happened, but there was continuity. And talking to the locals, the Bija and the Hadendawa tribes, they had a lovely sense of history too. If you could get them talking around a campfire one evening, they would talk about how they came down from the hills and defeated whoever had the nerve to land on the shore. And they were very proud of breaking a British square. And then you'd suddenly realise they were talking about another battle, and they were talking about when they defeated the Romans. So there's continuity. So that's partly why I find history so fascinating, the continuities that go on, and it gets locked into stages depending on whoever writes up what happens at the time. So my own work at the moment is I'm writing my mother's biography, which has got a lot about the fall of Singapore, but from the point of view of what happened to the women and children. And most of the literature on the fall of Singapore is what Professor Mary Beard describes as big books by blokes about battles, and is not actually, you know, what happened to the rest of us. So in a way I like it, a sort of subversive view of history as well. So but I haven't got any qualifications at all in history, not even O level.
What did you do in your working life? I didn't ask you that at the beginning.
My working life has always been strange because my mother died when I was at university doing chemistry, and I had to look after my father. And then when I married, our first child had learning disabilities. And because I was a trained scientist, even though I hadn't taken my finals because of the death of my mother, I started burning up on what is difficult about learning the preconcepts of mathematics. So I went and did a degree in education, specialising in that. Everybody thought I was bonkers, but there were no first degrees in special needs, but I knew what I wanted by then. So out of that developed a career in the sort of research side of mathematics in everyday life that never gets into the school curriculum. So what gets into the school curriculum is mainly a dilution of what the universities want. In the meantime, carpenters and knitters and people do amazingly mathematical things. So one of my historical amusements currently is I'm a member of the Society for the History of Medieval Technology. How do you build a cathedral with the technology you actually have at the time? So it's a strange career. I haven't stopped yet, although I've retired.
Sounds fantastic. Really interesting.
Well, I find it interesting.
Yeah.
It gives you also an escape from. I spent an awful lot of my time battling social services about the care of my daughter. And so what I do in my own time is entirely mine, and I find I can forget about it completely and get on with what I want to do, which is this biography, including what happened to the women and children of all races when Singapore fell, which is quite an interesting story. There's a massacre at sea that most people don't know about, for example.
Goodness me.
So horrendous things happened. Mm. Some very tough women came out of it.
Yeah, I'm sure. Mm. So in terms of your lifelong interest in history and archaeology, and you've mentioned about the significance of continuity within that. You mentioned you've got children. Mm. How has your sense of history and your passion for history and learning and that understanding and insight informed how you've brought them up or what you've shared with them?
Well, interestingly enough, there's my daughter who went to what was in those days, I'm afraid, called an educationally subnormal school. She happened to have a very good teacher, and she came home one day talking about the Romans. So she's interested in Romans. So that was easy. We could, I could trundle around the city of London at weekend looking for Romans. The London Museum we knew very well. And we went to have a look at, there was an exhibit recently when they found that well with all the working parts in it. And we went to have a look because they'd done a copy of it in the garden of the Museum of London. And there were these slaves, turning the handle and people shouting at them and get on with it. And we joined in that. And she was at a sort of a college when she left school, which is up on Hadrian's Wall. So for one holiday, I had a little van in those days, a little camper van. We did the whole of Hadrian's Wall, bed and breakfasting and camping. And we did there's a possibility of moving her out of London to a Camp Hill community in Yorkshire. And she knows that York was a Roman place because we've been there and looked at museums. And we were walking along the road, and I said, I think there might be a Roman fort there. And so we crossed the road, and she said, oh, yes, you can tell by the shape of the square shapes on the ground that that's a Roman fort. Now, this is a woman who's supposed to have learning disabilities. So there's another sort of continuity in the family there. I don't think my son's much interested, but I find it very intriguing that she is.
Yeah, that's a very beautiful, description, I suppose, picture of, your father's, interest in, but it seemed like it was almost more than an interest at the time when he was a prisoner of war, because it was kind of like an aid to his survival, I think, almost.
Well, it was. I mean, everybody read everything they could lay their hands on. And obviously they were passed around this incredibly overcrowded camp. And for the first year or so, when they were not beginning to starve, my father said you could almost see the attractions of monastic life. And everybody, there were a lot of academics and senior civil servants and people, because all the younger people had been fighting. And they gave lectures in their own subject. So you could go to lectures on all sorts of things. So it was like a mini university. Somebody's written a book about the barbed, I think they call it barbed wire university, but that was her. She did her research in the military camps. This Changi, where my father was a civilian camp, and so it had all these highbrow civil servants in it, too old to fight.
That's really
interesting. So a lot of education went on, and a lot of scientific experiment. You know, my father, with a couple of engineers and somebody else, they built this salt extraction plant. There was a shortage of salt, and they were allowed to go and collect seawater, and they evaporated it down and sold the salt to the Japanese, and made chemicals for the camp hospital. There was a lot of that sort of thing went on. Yes, interesting times, really.
Yeah, very interesting, and much, I suppose, much more varied than you might think from looking at it from the distance of years and, you know, a different generation not really understanding the full complexity, really, of how people were surviving. Because that's still about survival in a way, isn't it?
Yes.
But it's quite a...
But the generations before television were very much more self-reliant. As well as the rationing went on, we girls learnt to cook and sew at a very early age, and we're horrified now when we get together what you see on television about the amount of waste food. We don't know what waste food is. Food is something you just do not waste. And we all knew how to unpick our clothes and make them into other clothes. And it's what you did. In my own house, in my study here, down the other end of the same room, I've got a workshop. I put up my own shelves. I do all that sort of thing. I'm beginning to lose a bit of heave-ho nowadays and have to pay somebody to do that. But I still do most of that sort of stuff myself. And I think our whole generation does. I think... And we certainly know how to make meals out of very little basic ingredients. So it's sometimes a bit irritating when the sort of younger generation gets a bit patronising, us poor old things that can't manage this and that. Of course we can.
Absolutely, my goodness. It's quite ironical, that, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, well, I think we're probably getting to the end. Is there anything else that's sprung to mind that we haven't touched on or that you'd like to add?
I don't think so. I think this is a puff for the Museum of London, really. It's such a brilliant place. I was with a couple of friends, also retired from the education business, one a primary school head and one a county inspector, and they were staying with me. They live in Yorkshire, and we went to have a check the museum because they hadn't seen it for a while. And while we were just going into it, a woman walked by in obviously a Roman matron, and we thought, yes, well, that's interesting. So we followed her to see where she was going, and she was an actor. And she was going to visit a primary school who had come to see a certain exhibit in the Roman part of the museum. And she was absolutely brilliant. She stuck to her part the whole time. She pretended the children were slaves in a slave market, and she was sort of deciding which ones had good teeth and which ones were fat enough to lift things. And it was absolutely brilliantly done. So there have been changes in the way history is taught. The children were absolutely goggle-eyed, and as tired old education professionals, we were absolutely blown away by it. She was brilliant. She was brilliant. We actually wrote to the museum afterwards and said how good it had been. So I think there's a lot more is being done now. I've never actually made one of these beachcombing days down by the tower when the tide is out and everybody goes down and picks bits out of the river, and you see rows of children with toothbrushes and basins cleaning up finds. So it's still alive, I think, history. It's good. We were just very lucky at our time. In a way, it was a good thing that came out of the blitz in London, that the city of London had been knocked flat. And up popped the Roman stuff, including Mithras's head.
Well, I think that's a really lovely place to end. Good. Both of those images are really nice.
Good.
How old were the school children that you saw in the...
They would have been primary, sort of, you know, 9, 10, something like
that. Yeah.
Yeah. And she was just pinching their arms to see if they were fat enough.
Fantastic.
No, she was absolutely brilliant. Actually, there was a lovely image. They did a reenactment of the Battle Bridge battle at King's Cross not long ago, this summer. And there's a wonderful picture of Roman Essex girl, two Roman matrons and a slave. Somebody just snapped them, and it's not posed at all. And there they're taking time off from their enactments. And they're still in Roman dress, and they've got their feet off in the fountain, and the slave is sort of massaging somebody's feet. And there are these two Roman women just looking like some stereotype Essex tart. And it's absolutely wonderful. If I could switch this thing on, I might be able to find it.
Sounds great. Okay, thank you, Mary.